Well, I was going to talk about the fact that you fucking talked about what I was eating tonight. What was the purpose of that conversation? Yeah. Why'd you tweet it?
Why can't I tweet it?
No, because you just wanted people to feel sorry for you.
That, I did. I had to watch you eat my very favourite pizza in the whole world.
Yeah, but you didn't have to tweet and then make people flagellate me online.
No one flagellated you.
I didn't actually read the tweets.
I don't think a single person flagellated you. People were just barracking for having a 4-hour podcast. By the way, no.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, not a Hugo-nominated podcast devoted – well, we didn't get nominated.
No.
No. Anyway, devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip, but we did get nominated for a DITMAR and a Kronos, and
we're
very, very happy about that. They're not international awards, so I don't get to strut my stuff on an international stage, but still it's nice.
Your time may come.
I doubt it. So I'm Ian Mond. To my left is Kirsten McDermott.
Good evening.
Now, Kirsten, there's something.
What?
There's something I forgot to do.
What?
Did you hear that? Well, you could see the rustling.
I can see the rustling. You have a plastic bag.
Yes, I have a plastic bag. See, you know how Rob Shearman was staying in your house like 2 months ago? A
couple of months ago, yeah.
And you probably thought to yourself, why didn't he give us like a going away gift? Because that would have been a sign of being nice.
No, I didn't think
you
that.
You did. I would have thought that. I would have thought if someone stays in my house for like 2 weeks or whatever it was, or a week, whatever it was, I think, shit, well, where's my gift?
He did our podcast. I thought that was a nice present.
Yeah, but I mean, all he had to do was sit down and talk. Big deal. He actually did buy you a gift. He bought you a gift. Actually, we actually spent a good 45 minutes in the airport looking for a gift for you.
For a gift, and that's in that
bag. For you and Jason. It's in this bag. It's been sitting in my bedside table since he left. He doesn't know this, and he hasn't actually listened to the podcast that often, so he may never know.
Oh, see, now he probably thinks I'm really rude because he gave me a gift and I haven't even said thank you.
And the thing is, does it still have the price tag? Yes, it
does. It's a box of chocolates.
No, I took the price tag off. So it's a box of chocolates. Ernest Hillier.
Yum.
Milk and dark. We should probably eat them now for the podcast because we don't want them to get old. The expiry date.
Yeah, they expire in May next year. I think I'll put these away.
Yeah, that's the preservatives.
Well, thank you, Rob, if you're listening, and I'll send you a little message via Twitter anyway, and thank you.
Yeah, and I'm sorry,
not
Rob.
Belated from you, belated from Ian.
It was an honest mistake. You're honest in the fact that I didn't eat them.
That's very honest.
They're still in their original wrapping.
Because
I didn't,
you
like,
wouldn't
re-wrap
have
them.
Had to tell me.
No, I could have just
eaten
them.
But you could have just eaten them. I wouldn't have known. Rob just thought. Would have thought I was really rude for not thanking him for the chocolate.
I could have lied to her. I could have just said I gave them to her and she's just a bitch, didn't bother to say thanks. And what a waste of 45 minutes in the airport that was. So,
thank you. Thank you for my delectable chocolate assortment.
Ernest Hillier. Look how much writing there is on the back, which tells you it's quality chocolate, when they have to explain in like 5 paragraphs how good their chocolate is, unless that's the ingredient list.
Yum. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, great. So thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Thanks for the chocolates. I mean, thanks for buying chocolates for Kirsten that I didn't give her till now. So,
We should move on to the actual podcast.
Yeah, that wasn't staged. I swear, I just remember now that I'd forgotten.
Okay.
Should we go on? Aurealis Awards.
Aurealis Awards.
Now, why did you go to Sydney? I know for the Aurealis Awards.
I went to Sydney for the Aurealis Awards.
But I knew you were a convener as well.
I was a convener of the judging panel for the horror category, yes.
Did you win anything?
No, I was a convener of the horror panel.
But did they just give you an award? Don't they just give you awards?
No, they don't give me awards. I have to do stuff for them.
You did stuff last year.
Yeah, but I wasn't eligible because I was a judge. Oh. I can't judge my own work.
So how was the party?
Oh, it was fun.
There's some great photos.
Really nice award ceremony.
I've seen some really, really good photos taken by Kat Sparks.
Yeah, no, it's a great award ceremony. Spec Faction in Sydney done a really good job both years, actually, that they've run it. They're doing it again next year, so that'll be a lot of fun.
So I should go to Sydney?
You should.
It means going to Sydney.
It does mean going to Sydney, but only for one night. And really, it just means going to one hotel in Sydney and walking around the corner. Literally, the theatre is literally around the corner. We all just kind of gathered in the hotel lobby and just swanned around the block.
How big is the theatre?
Oh, it's a big theatre. I don't know how many people would see, but I mean, it's the independent theatre in North Sydney.
You're saying that like I should go, oh my God, the independent.
Well, you know, it's a large.
Like 500 people?
Maybe. I'm terrible at judging that, honestly.
Was it packed?
Yeah, it was.
There really?
Was
a lot... Who the fuck turned up?
It's a big night, Ian.
There's like the nominees, of which there's, what, 30 or 40 of them. Yeah. Their family. And a few strays. I mean,
no, it's a whole bunch of because you catch up with. I mean, it's the awards ceremony, which is awesome, but it's also just catching up with people. It's like a tiny
500 to a fucking convention.
No, they didn't get 500.
I've just picked that figure. All right, 350.
I don't know.
All right,
a couple hundred anyway.
Is this the wrong questions to be asking?
Yes, it is. It is for me. You can email Spec Faction if you like and ask them about the ticket sales. But there were a lot of people and it was a lot of fun. And a
lot of smiles, I noticed. So I'm assuming everyone was happy with who won the awards. That was a segue.
I assume so.
So no one was saying, really, they won? That was a bit shit. No one.
Why would people say that? Why would people say that outside their own head?
No, listen, Kirsten. You've been to conventions and you've been to award ceremonies.
Yes.
And you know that when you get to the pub after the award ceremony, when, you know, you've had a couple of drinks, the words start
coming. And all the winners are still there.
Yeah, but you don't stand next to the winners because they're being cliquey and look at my award and how shiny it is. And if you're someone like me and you've never won an award in your life but been nominated a couple of times, not as many as Ben Peake, but still been nominated a couple of times and never won anything, you get a little bit, you know, upset.
Okay. Well,
I wouldn't call it jealousy.
I didn't see a lot of that. I saw very happy people, you know.
Yeah, it looked genuinely, I mean, seriously, it looked genuinely like a very jovial
it was.
Party.
It was
I actually
fun.
Really feel bad I didn't go.
You should go next year. It's a lot of fun.
All right, I'll see if I can call.
And,
you
know, it's one night. Like, we flew up on the Saturday morning and we flew home on the Sunday morning.
Did you get drunk?
Yes.
Yeah, great. No puking, though. That's good.
No, don't do that.
So, we don't have to go through the whole list.
No, let's not go through the whole list.
Because that's not that sort of – we're not that sort of podcast. We'll leave that to others.
I am going to point out, though, that two books that we reviewed in the last 12 months won awards, which was Bluegrass Symphony by Lisa Hannett for Best Collection.
Awesome. And that was up against it was up against Bad Power, wasn't it?
It was up against Bad Power. I don't have the list of nominees here. It was up against Paul Haynes's collection. I think Sue Isles' book was there, and I think Tansy Raina Roberts' book was there. I only have the winners.
Really, really strong.
Yeah. So that one, and also The Courier's New Bicycle by Kim Westwood won the science fiction novel category, and it was really funny because this award, so I was not nominated for anything. I'm just there. I'm having fun. It was awesome. And I'm sitting there and the nominee list for best science fiction novel came up and I was just sitting there and suddenly it was like, oh, Kim has to win this.
you started getting sweat.
I got really anxious. I was like, and they announced her name and it was wonderful. And she was incredibly surprised.
Was she though? But I mean,
no, she really was. She really, really was. So yay for those two books. You know,
yay for all of them.
Oh, yay for all of them. Absolutely.
Especially the winner of the horror novel because that was no one. So now apparently
– I knew this would come up.
Well, only because I'm sitting here. I mean, so I thought, well, perfect opportunity. You were one of the judges.
I was.
Now, you picked a very, very strong short story list.
We did.
In fact, you couldn't decide for a single winner. You gave.
We really couldn't. There was much debate among the judges and we went back and forwards. And we really couldn't split the winner there.
And the judges were you, Stephanie Gunn and Chuffa.
Yes. Chuffa.
All right. Maybe Curlew. Is it Churlew or Curlew?
I think it's Churlew.
Chuffa.
Anyway.
To his friends. yes. So you gave the award.
And that was that was our short list that we came to, came at the end of long lists from all the judges over which there were a lot. I mean, it was a very hard list to come down to. This was not an easy decision to make out of, you know, five stories out of really, I mean, last year, you know, easily a couple dozen really,
and there were,
really
there were
strong,
a bunch of stories you could have put
stories
on the long list as well, weren't there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my personal long list, I think, had about 10 stories.
Wow. Okay.
That I found it really hard. Because as I went through, I had a spreadsheet, and as I went through, I was highlighting on an Excel spreadsheet. Anything I thought just wasn't in the running would just get highlighted red, Anything that I absolutely loved that I thought, yes, really, this should go on a shortlist, highlighted green. And ones that I thought were really good and you know, if there weren't a lot of green ones, I'd consider them for the list. They got yellow. And that was kind of an optimistic color coding scenario, because when I got to the end, I think I had about 15 green stories that I then had to go through. It's like, oh, sorry, you yellow guys. You don't get a second chance. I need to now cull my green list. It was an incredibly strong year for short fiction.
So the winners for the short story were The Past is a Bridge, Best Left Burnt by Paul Haynes in Last Days of Kali Yuga, which I haven't read, but I have the collection.
Oh, it's an awesome story. It is so good.
And the short go of Future in 8 Seconds, which I have read, by Lisa L. Hannett in Bluegrass Symphony, which I don't think is the best story in that collection nor the best horror story. Yeah, that's the one you chose. No, it's a great story. Don't get me wrong, but I think there's even stronger pieces in there, but that's a matter of taste.
Yeah, so. I think there were about three of Lisa's stories, maybe even four of Lisa's stories ended up on like individual judges' long lists. It's a very strong collection. I'm really glad it won the Best Collection Award.
Yeah, without giving spoilers to the rest of the podcast, Bad Power, for me, would give it a run for the money.
Yeah. So, well, we'll get to that.
But we'll get to that. So you've done a brilliant job there at segueing away from the fact that horror novel had no winner.
Yes, we had no winner.
You, Stephanie and Chufa, couldn't come to a decision on even a short list. You had a short list.
No,
you didn't have anything. You had a sort of vaguely notable book list.
We gave two honourable mentions to two books, which were The Broken Ones by Stephen Irwin and The Business of Death by Trent Jemison, which is the third of the Deathworks trilogy. And the reason why we gave honourable nominations to those two books was that they really did stand head and shoulders above the rest of the field. I will point out that there are only 12 eligible novels for the horror category. And when I say eligible, they were the ones that were put forward. In my opinion, about half of them weren't actually eligible for reasons of genre. So we didn't have a lot of books to work with.
And not you're not talking like just on the verge. You're saying books that are so not horror.
Well, horror is one of those subjective genres. So, I mean, if you have a look at our shortlist for short stories, you can see the range that we were, you know, working in with the horror genre. It wasn't a conservative definition of the genre by any means. So we thought the Jamison and the Irwin books should be singled out from the other 10 as being significantly better. But they just didn't quite get there in terms of giving them award. And this is the thing.
Without getting too bitchy, is that because there was a fundamental flaw in both of them that just you felt didn't get it on?
And we've submitted – I mean, there are judges' reports that you can look at. But also neither of them were squarely within the genre either. But, I mean, the big problems with Trent's book, it was a third volume in a series, and I've been saying for a while there really should be an award which acknowledges trilogies and series and multi-book stories, because it's really – it's not unknown, and it has happened where a part of a trilogy has won an award on its own merit. But it's really hard. And sometimes it's like reading half a book and saying, well, should that win an award? So I'd love –
Tansy won for a second book.
For the last Creature Court? That's nominated.
No, but last year's –
The last year's was the first book.
Was that for the
– Yes.
No, I thought she won for book two.
I thought she won for the first one. We'll need to look at this. Sorry.
Once again, you haven't prepared well enough, Kirsten.
Well, if you throw questions at me out of left field. Yes. I'm pretty sure, wasn't it Power and Majesty that won?
Why are you speaking in a slightly British accent?
Was I?
Yeah. Well, you said, why wasn't it Power and Majesty that won?
I'm sorry, that came out of nowhere. Anyway, the point is, like parts of
– Tansy is saying it to us right now.
It's easier for first books to win than it is for second or third volumes to win. And I would really – I'd love to see an award that acknowledges a multi-book – story at the conclusion of its story, it's logistically so hard.
I mean, look, you've got George R. Martin, who's been nominated for a Hugo for book six. Pretty much, I'd say, it's either him or China, and I think he could win it, George, because, again, so if you're big enough,
you do
and
have
famous
an overwhelming popularity factor in there.
Yeah,
though.
Well, that's true. Oh, so, whereas you're saying this is a judged award.
This
so
is a juried award,
and a juried award. And so,
I think parts of multi-book stories are inherently at a disadvantage because they are, by their nature, telling part of a story, and second and third volumes of those stories are at a greater disadvantage than first volumes.
And the Irwin you felt just didn't fit squarely enough into the horror category.
There was a world building problem with that book that didn't really get past
it had a fundamental flaw. It was a good book, but it had a fundamental flaw. Okay.
And when you're looking at things like the Aurealis Awards, which has a 17-year heritage behind it, and you look at the books that have won the award in the past, and they're not like there's occasionally a book there that you look at and it's like, why is that there? That just but you don't just want to give an award to the best book that was published that year if that book isn't actually really brilliant.
It's obviously an award with pedigree in the fact that 350 to 500 people are willing to turn up on
I don't think there were that many.
Oh, whatever.
They're expanding numbers.
Yeah, full theatre is willing to be there.
Look, it is Australia's premier genre award, undoubtedly. And that's something you have to consider when you're judging things. And we, as a panel, we didn't think that any award last year, any book last year was worthy of the Aurealis Award for a horror novel. So I'm really hoping that changes.
I've never heard of Ember and Ash by Pamela Freeman. Just wanted to point that out. So I'm going to go on that.
That was the best fantasy novel.
Yeah, the best fantasy novel. Sorry, I cut you down there. I didn't mean to. I just noticed
that. That was an interesting segue.
Yeah. No, well, the other segue I wanted to make about the Aurealis Awards was the Peter McNamara Conveners Award.
Yes, which went to Galactic Suburbia.
Yes. Now, interesting. So how does the convener thing work? That's all the judges and all the categories get together and
Not all the judges, the convener of each category has a convener who sort of manages that category and is responsible for chasing up the other judges. And
you were the convener of horror?
Yes.
So you actually had a say in this award?
Yes.
Okay, well, leave it at that. No, I'm not asking you to give away
secrets.
No,
that's how it works. The conveners each separately nominate someone they would like to see win the award, and the nominations are put together, and then the conveners discuss between themselves of the people who've been nominated who they think should get the award. And that's basically how it works.
I'm very happy that they got it.
Yes, and they were very excited.
Well, it would have come as a surprise to them.
No, you find out about the Peter Mac a little beforehand.
Oh, is that why they turned up? Did they know before the 12th of May when they did their last podcast?
I don't know when they're told, but they are told because it's a pretty, it's one award. There's no nominations list, so there's no indication before the award is announced who might get it. So, and then the people who present it would really, really like the person to be there to accept it. So they are told. I don't know how long in advance they're told, but they are given a heads up, so they do get a chance to come along.
How much cash do they get?
Actually, normally it's nothing, but this year the copyright agency sponsored the award, and I think there was a $500 cash prize.
You're shitting me.
Yeah, no, it's the first time though. And normally it's just an award. It's just an honorary thing. But yeah, the copyright agency sponsored it. So they don't know if that'll happen again next year. It might be a one-off, or they might sponsor it again, or they might get another sponsor. I don't know.
What's the award? Is that the one with the big tray or
the what?
What's
Oh, there's no. Oh no, I think you might be thinking of the other Peter Mac award.
There's another one? No, yeah. Really. What's the award?
I don't think there's an award. They got an envelope.
So let me get this
which
straight.
I assume had the 500.
Possibly one of the most important awards given out on the night, and you get an envelope.
I'm not.
And if you're lucky, someone's sponsors and gives you cash.
I don't think there was a trophy. I don't know what was done in
there's
other
no
years.
Oh, come on.
I didn't see one. They weren't carrying one around. I don't know. But, it's nice to have things to put on your shelf. But, I mean, it's the award that counts.
Yeah, but unless they're – look, let me tell you something. When I was young, I hope you've got a few minutes.
The opinions of Ian Mond are not necessarily the opinions of this podcast.
They are the opinions of this podcast. There is an award at school called the Vonnie Cooper Smith Award for Best Public Speaking, and Year 11s and Year 12s both go for it. Well, no, it was actually Year 10s and Year 11s. I went for 2 years in a row, and I missed out by an inch because I did two fantastic talks, but I just wasn't good enough, apparently. My father said it had to do with the prepositions at the end of each of my sentences. That's why I lost. But then he was always picking on me like that. I could go in so much detail on that. But anyway, the point is you didn't get an award. You got actually etched onto a board that still sits on the wall at Yavna School in Elsternwick, etched your name.
Well,
and I'm not on the board because I didn't win.
I mean, if you
they get etched?
If you look at the wall as, you know,
the
internet, then yes, their name is etched on the internet as being a winner of the Peter McNamara.
Look, I may have
award.
Slightly gone off topic here, but the point is, I think the point is that they should have got a proper award.
Oh, for God's sake!
No, the point. No,
the opinions of Ian Mond, and not necessarily the opinions of Kirsten McDermott.
No, the point is that it is wonderful that they won because, as I said on my blog, which they actually noted in their last episode, they did change my neural pathways.
Yes.
At 37.
Yes. So it, no.
And my wife struggles. Changed my neural pathways, but they did really well, and they really have pushed forward. I mean, one of the main reasons why I did my little DIPMAR charts, you know, the little colour charts mm-hmm. I did, was to show the sort of that growth of women writers getting nominated on the DIPMAR ballot, and to show that trend as it's grown, and it really has. And you can pick a date around 2009, 2010, just about the time Galactic Suburbia starts, 12th Planet Press starts, all those things, and suddenly, bang, you see this shift from what is basically male centric, although not always, but was predominantly mm-hmm. in the longer, especially in the longer fiction side of the DIPMARs, male centric to a more female centric award.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, when women are published and talked about. Get awards.
That is hilarious. So that was the Aurealis Awards. Anything else you want to mention about the Aurealis Awards?
No, just a congratulations to all the nominees and winners. It's a fine reading list, actually, if you go through all the categories.
And how was Kate as a MC?
Oh, she was wonderful. She had these amazing red gloves that reminded me of the Holly Black books.
Okay, well, that's what you were thinking of as Kate was talking.
I seriously was the whole time. I was thinking, Kate can't touch anyone.
Did she do any gags?
No.
Any roasts?
That kind of, no. Okay. She's lovely. Kate is wonderful.
I know Kate's lovely, but I'm just saying she might have said a couple of, you know, off-colored gags about the nominees.
No.
Okay.
She said lovely things about the nominees.
Okay, great. So anything before we get to the books, I think there's something else you wanted to mention according to this piece of paper.
According to the running sheet.
Yeah, the running sheet.
Yes. Following up from our episode last month when we were talking about stick figures and you were getting a little bit upset.
It's not I was upset. You drew this stick figure with sort of like this weird bit of shit falling off at all.
But it was a line. Yeah. I mean, you can interpret that line the way you
want. No. It was a line, but then you coloured that line in repeatedly, so it got bigger. And so it looked like a bit of intestine.
Okay. Anyway, yes. Following on from that,
yes.
I got a little excited about our whole discussion, and Sean Wright, Sean the Bloggernaut, pointed me towards a website called Zazzle, which is kind of like Cafe Press, but it's in Australia. And I maybe spent an afternoon maybe designing a whole bunch of stickers and T-shirts and badges and magnets and stuff and put them up on Zazzle, which I haven't made public yet, but I think I will. And I've ordered some stuff, and unfortunately it hasn't come in time for this podcast, except for the stickers, which look really cool.
They do.
But the motif is basically your standard stick figure, coloured red, because I figured that's a fairly gender-neutral colour. And it's your standard stick figure. So, you know, it's a line up and down and an arm and a leg and a head, two arms and two legs and a head. And that's all it is. And then it's got the word female next to it, which I really like. So I can't wait for my T-shirt to arrive. I'm going to wear it to Continuum if it arrives in time. So I think I'll make that shop public. So if people want to buy Writer and the Critic merch.
Which says, well, she still says writer on the critic on it. The little sign
there. Little tiny yeah. unobtrusive little print. Yeah. But yeah, basically you it's just a standard stick figure that has been designated female. And if people ask you what it means, you can get to ask them why they think that stick figure isn't female.
Brilliant.
And why women have to be a subset of the male. So there
are
t-shirts?
Are there t-shirts for people as large as me?
There's actually one of the reasons I like Zazzle was because I think unlike Cafe Press, at least the last time I looked at Cafe Press, is it actually had really big sizes. Okay. There's I think it goes up to double XL or something like that for men and women, which is good because you usually get a lot of big guy sizes. You don't often get a lot of larger women-sized T-shirts, which is really good because, you know, women who are larger or women who just like baggy shirts, it's really hard to find.
Okay. Well,
so I will think I'll make that public and we'll put a link in the show notes and you can go buy your stick figure merch.
Yeah. Well, I'll buy some. And the money will go to?
Most of the money goes to Zazzle, unfortunately. I think we're going to make like 50 cents to a dollar or something off what people
Which will go
buy.
To pay for the microphone.
Which will go to pay for our hosting fees primarily.
Yeah, we're not relying on it is what we're saying.
Oh, no. It'd be nice if we make, you know, like 5% profit, which I think is what our margin is, then that'll pay for the hosting fees, maybe. Maybe not. But, yeah, so we'll put a link in the show notes and you can pop along to the Zazzle store and check out the merch that I got a little bit carried away making. And hopefully my T-shirt will arrive and I can wear it to Continuum, which would be nice.
So the next segue is into the actual books themselves.
Yay.
We recommended two books.
Well, we did.
I recommended Bad Power by Deborah Biancotti.
Yep.
And you recommended Margot Lanigan's Sea Hearts.
Yes, which we'll discuss second. Pulled,
yeah, well, I'm holding the copy of Sea Hearts. You just ripped it from my hands for no particular reason.
No, because I see it and I just go, mine.
It's not yours, though.
They're all mine. Sorry.
Whoa. Someone needs a pointy stick. So we're going to start with Bad Power by Deb.
With Bad Power.
Who we both know and love.
Yes.
That doesn't mean we're going to love her work. Might have slightly spoiled.
You are so mean.
No, I've already said.
You've just given her a heart attack.
No, I haven't, because she knows. I just said 20 minutes. She'd be listening to the start of the podcast. She knows that I thought that it would have given Bluegrass Symphony a run.
Mean,
no,
mean man.
Don't say that. That's not true. No, I mean, actually.
Yes.
This is really important.
Yes.
We know Deb.
Yes.
And we know Elisa.
Yes.
And you're actually doing a book for 12th Planet Press.
I am. I'll be doing one of the 12 Planets, which will be out next year.
And while it doesn't need to be said, we don't give people free passes on this show.
Oh, God, no.
If something is shit, we take it apart.
We do.
And so I want to make it very
and
clear.
And we have done.
Yes, and we have done. And so in spite of the fact that we know, and it's the same with the Above and Below, and we did that in a previous podcast. Yeah. In spite of all that, I happen to love Bad Power, and I love it unreservedly.
Unreservedly.
There is not a single
reservation.
No. Not a single reservation. There isn't a dud sentence in the book. There isn't a dud – I should have probably started bigger. There isn't a dud story. There isn't a dud sentence. There ain't a dud comma.
There's a couple of typos.
Are there?
Yep.
Really?
Yep. Sorry.
There's a couple of typos, but they ain't duds either. Those are the best typos you will find in a collection of stories. Seriously, 12th Planet Press. Look, Elisa, this is between you and me here. No, it's not between you, the whole world. You're producing some of the best quality work in Australia. I know there are other small press publishers in Australia, and I know there are other small press publishers across the world, but you are producing some of the most important and best work. And this book, if anyone's been doubting should I, shouldn't I, just go buy Bad Power by Deb Biancotti. Just go do it, okay? And we haven't gone into spoilers yet, so if you haven't bought it and you're thinking, oh, I'll listen to what we have to say about it, well, I'm just telling you, you agree, Kirsten?
I agree.
Yes, so
definitely.
It gets out. Stamp of approval. Just go buy it and support.
We should
this
actually
wonderful
get a stamp.
Of approval?
No, like a stamp that we can then. Anyway,
This was my Richard the Fifth speech.
I'm still doing Zazzle things. I think Zazzle does stamps. Never mind. goes another afternoon.
Doing my big speech. I'm letting it all out. I'm letting my emotions through, and you cut me off with some zazzle crap. Anyway.
Stamp of approval.
Stamp of approval. So go now. Assuming you've all gone away and come back because you've now bought it and read it. And I think, is there an e-book version of this? There might be, there may not be.
I'm not sure. I know Charles Tan is doing the e-books for 12th Planet, and I don't know if he's gotten up to Debs yet or not.
Okay.
So there will be one in the near future if there is not one already.
But actually, you should get the hard versions. The hard versions. Well, that sounds slightly pornographic. You should get the hard copy versions because they're gorgeous packages.
It's going to make a beautiful little set of these 12
books. Amanda Rainey is wonderful for the cover art.
Yeah, the design work in these books is just beautiful.
Extremely simplistic. Oh, that sounds bad as well. Not simplistic. It's
simple.
Yeah. But gorgeous.
It's simple and clean and yeah.
Exactly.
And even though all the covers are different, they clearly belong to a set.
Yes. So why did I love Bad Power so much?
I don't know, Ian. Why did you love
Bad Power? I was hoping you could answer that one for me. But the reason I loved it is because it introduces you to a world of superheroes gone wrong, but they're not really superheroes. They're people with powers.
Yes, yeah.
Because superhero implies costumes and capes and actually saving people from, terrible disaster, whereas these are people who have come across powers for whatever reason, who are very...
Oh, they seem to be born with the powers.
No, I don't think that's true. No, I think you'll find that...
Born with the power.
No.
And they just discover they have it at some stage.
Oh, well, all right.
Like, no one's getting bitten by a spider or dropped in a vat of atomic waste or anything like that. Like, it's a...
No, because Matthew doesn't have his power until Web of Lies and his power is basically hearing the dead. We did read the same book, didn't we?
Yes, no, we did, but he's discovered the power.
Yeah, okay, all right, yeah. Okay, fine. Yes, it's obviously in their genetics,
yeah.
But it doesn't come, it doesn't instantiate itself until a specific point in time. How's that?
Very
instantiate.
Good. Very good.
But this is about what would happen.
I think that's important because it is intrinsic power. It's not something that happened to you. It's something you have yourself.
Okay. And essentially these stories are about, well, they're not just the what if I had this power, how cool would it be, but...
Oh, it's not cool.
No. What if I had this power and I really didn't want it and it fucked my life up? And actually the beginning story, Shades of Grey...
Which is an awesome story.
Yeah, it is.
It's such a good beginning.
Yeah, it's a man who literally is trying to kill him. Well, he's trying
to
kill
himself. He can't die.
He can't die.
Yeah.
So he's seeing how far he can take this, I can't die. So if he flings his car off a 12, 20, 50-story building and it plummets to the ground and it smashes into teeny bits and he literally gets turned into paste, what happens? Well, apparently he re-knits himself into a new body.
Yes.
But painful though it is, and he feels the pain.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's not like he just wakes up. It's not Groundhog Day. Oh, I'm alive now. Yeah, his body recreates itself with all of the attendant pain that kind of healing would have.
And that's the opening story, and that just sets the scene for the next four stories. Although I notice there's five stories in
there
this.
There is five.
Not the traditional four.
No. I think Deb's cheated a little with
– Oh, yeah, because it's her. Because the editor wouldn't have said you can have a fifth story. It's Deb. Deb's cheated. She slotted a story.
Well, this book – so it is five. Most of the 12 planets are just the four stories. I mean, but it's no bigger. They are actually five quite short stories. Whereas some of the other 12th Planet books have had a novella in there to pad out the size. Well, not to pad out, but to bring the size. Whereas Deb's would be a much slimmer book if you took out one of the stories. And I'm not sure which one you'd take out.
If I'm not mistaken, because I think Elisa has said it, that one of the stories was going to be in the Deb's collection, but either didn't fit or something, and so got put into this, and then Deb wrote a bunch of stories around
that. Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know which one was which. Actually, I suppose if there's one thing that's missing, which I happen to like, is little afterwards and introductions. There's an introduction.
There's an intro. They all have intros.
Written by Anne Vandermeer. No, but the author, you know how Stephen King at the end of his, you think that's a wank, don't you?
No,
like a little paragraph that says Shades of Grey came. I was on the toilet one day, and I don't know. You know what I'm saying? That
I don't mind those if they're done well, but I don't miss them when they're not there. And sometimes they're just like like, yeah, really? You just had to write an afterword for every story, didn't you? And some things you had nothing to say.
Now,
so I like that these are compact little collections with, you know, with a very short intro. They've all got just like a couple of pages of an intro. It's not like it doesn't go on for pages and pages. I really like these collections. And I've read this one twice because the interesting thing is I read it late last year when it came out and I liked it. I liked it a lot. But it was right in the middle of my Aurealis reading. And it was, I think maybe some of the stories in there were nominated. I'm not sure. But I just read the whole thing anyway as a thing. And then when you said we're going to do it for the podcast, I thought I'd better reread it because it kind of all blurred as just, you know, more short stories that I'd read with a whole bunch of other short stories. And I read it again and it was almost a different book. It was really.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what stood out to you? Because Bear Power, the story within the Bear Power, the collection.
That's my favourite story now. It wasn't the first time I read it, but now it really.
Because I know a lot of people like Cross That Bridge, the last story. I'm actually a really big fan of Palming the Lady.
Yeah, Palming the Lady's good.
Because it's not often you get crazy old ladies as the focus of a story. Actually, that's probably not entirely true. There's actually probably a tradition.
I think
she's a bag lady.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, the focus of the story is actually Detective Palmer.
Well, yeah, okay.
But, no, I think Bad Power is my favourite story. And it's the one that sticks out. It's written in a different type of language, a different style. It's the only one that's set in a very outback rural setting as opposed to a city. It just stands out from the others.
Well, it literally stands out as in it has no connection to the other four because the other four are connected in some way.
Oh, it's connected?
What did I miss?
It's deeply connected.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, sorry. Oh, that's right. So this is when I...
Yeah.
Since reading Bear Power, listeners, I've started tagging, you know, underlining bits because I know I forget stuff.
But you can't do that with the 12th Planet book.
I know, because they're too nice. Although I did do it with Sea Hearts. You didn't hear I said that. Okay. And
do you know what my mum said to me when I was really little? And I was probably about 3 or 4 or something and I drew in a book, probably even younger than that actually. Might be one of my earliest memories. And I just drew in a book like a 3-year-old does. And I remember my mum showing me, she didn't get angry. She got sad and she showed me the book and said, "We don't do this to books. If you draw in a book, you're drawing on the author's soul."
Oh my God. She said that.
I know. Yep.
OMG.
And I think I to this day I find it really, really hard to annotate a book.
Okay. Well, Deb, I didn't draw on your soul, I swear. So why Bear Power? Why is that the strongest story?
It's just the one that hit me the hardest this time. I don't think the first time when I read it I really paid a lot of attention to that story. Because I think it did feel like the odd story out. And the second time I loved the narrating character. I didn't love what happened to her, but really, her power is that people will do what she tells them. So if she says go away, they will go away. There's this one point where she says to people who are attacking her, you know, go as far as your feet will carry her. And these poor people are just endlessly walking away, wearing their feet down
and
to
not
stubs.
Surprisingly, people see this. And
yeah, and sort of regard her as a witch.
A witch, correct. Yeah. And basically. And
there's that horrible, horrible thing they do with locking up her face with chains and like sort of like a Scold's Bridle was the impression that I got of it being. And it's just such it's such a different story from the other four and it's so visceral and what B and Cotty's been able to do is just, I don't know, I could almost taste the dirt in that book and like it's so, yeah, and it's such a good story. I really, really love it. It might be my favourite now, I think.
See, for me, I got a bit upset because the collection was setting up a lot of little threads, like the Grey Institute, which is a bit like the Xavier Institute in a sense from X-Men. sort of.
Yeah, yep.
And I had that, and I'm watching a lot of Fringe at the moment.
Oh, okay.
And it had that Fringe sort of feel to it as well. And Detective Palmer has a certain, because she knows about the weird stuff, so she's got a slightly X-File-y, Fringe-y sort of feel to her. And yet it then ended. And I thought, I really want more. I really genuinely would read an Olive set in this world tomorrow. Well, maybe not tomorrow because we've got about 28,000 books to read. But,
certainly in a couple of months you'd read it.
Yeah, and I do. And in a sense, that's why I'd like a little afterward at the end, just for Deb to reassure me to say,
there's a novel coming.
There's a novel coming, or there's another bunch of short stories coming.
I don't know. I know she's working on a novel. I have no idea what it's about, whether it's set in this kind of a world or whether it's completely different or whether she's going anywhere else with – I hope she's going somewhere else with these characters because it does – I mean, you're right, it does feel like the beginning of something.
Yeah.
I definitely read a novel in this world. It's just awesome.
Yeah, look, it is. And then you finish it with – and we haven't gone through every story, but – with Cross That Bridge, which I know a lot of people like, and there's good reason for that, which, you know,
it's a nice ending.
Yeah.
It's a happy ending.
It's actually, well, that's it. To say that Deb doesn't always do happy stuff, this one is I wouldn't say it's cutesy, because that
it's not cutesy.
No, because, I mean, it has counter-terrorism stuff in it, but that,
it's really funny when the guy goes to the other house. I'm not going to spoil that because that will spoil the ending of that story. But what happens to him, like within a minute of his?
Why would you stop yourself?
Because I don't think we need to spoil everything. But yeah, what happens to him within like 30 seconds of his arrival is really funny.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's it. Oh, that's the other thing.
Yeah,
Deb's got a fantastic sense of humor. I mean,
oh, she does. She's got a really sardonic, dry.
I say that
sense
like how I sound really surprised and shocked, and because if you met Deb, she's a very funny person.
She's, yes,
and dry and sardonic.
Yes,
but you can get trapped into thinking that she just writes this sort of dark, you know, Shades of Grey, which actually is very funny too in many ways. It's also pretty bloody full on, and you could be led into thinking that, you know, she just likes that sort of dark misery stuff. But no, there's a really interesting vein of humour running through all the stories. You would agree?
Yeah, no, actually, yeah, even Bad Power, which is probably the nastiest of the stories, is quite funny. Actually,
yeah.
the narrator of that story is very funny.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's only 125 pages, so we can't speak for hours and hours about it.
No.
Since it's a taster for, I hope for more stuff in this world, although I wouldn't want her to be trapped writing books or short stories in this world, but I would like to see more.
You'd like to see more.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a good thing. I think that's one of the best things you can say about any book once you finish it is that you'd like to read more.
Yeah, and Deb deserves more international recognition. I mean, she's got the Shirley Jacksons have nominated, yes, Ishtar, the historian Ishtar,
yep,
of the title completely escapes me.
And the dead shall outnumber the living.
Well, there you go. Have you read it?
Yes, I have. And it's really, really good.
Oh, you've read the all three stories?
Yes.
Or?
Yes, no. It's a fantastic collection, actually. Debs and Kat Sparks' novellas in there have each of them been nominated for several awards. And I feel a little bit sorry for Karen Warren's story. It's a really good story and I like it, but it's unfortunately I think it's getting overlooked for awards because it's kind of a foundation story for the whole anthology.
Oh, okay.
So I was talking to Karen on the weekend actually and I was saying Kat and Deb get to kind of have the rock star stories, but if it wasn't for Karen's really, really great story, they couldn't have bounced off the way they did. So I think Karen's is being overlooked. The whole anthology is really, really good.
Yeah, and that's that's another small press. That's
Gilgamesh Press.
Gilgamesh Press, yeah. And again, and they've got a strong Australian connection because Amanda Piller.
Amanda Piller co-edited that with KV Taylor.
Okay.
I think Mark Denise was going to edit to begin with, but there was something happened and he passed it on to Amanda and KV.
So you
guys I don't know KV.
So I highly recommend that as well. Just
absolutely,
as an aside.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's really, really good. That's three Australian writers just doing phenomenal work.
So Bad Power gets our writer and the critic seal of approval.
Oh, it's a bang seal now.
Oh, whatever. Stamp, seal, money back guarantee. So if you buy it,
we can offer
no,
that.
Wait. If you buy it from Elisa or Tall Planet Press, she doesn't have to give you the money. I don't understand how that would work.
We can do that unless you want to do it.
No. Yeah, I hadn't really thought that through.
No,
I?
You hadn't.
Oh, well, that's
part of the course, really.
But
it does get our stamp/seal of approval.
Yes, it does. Fantastic stuff. On the other hand, sea hearts.
Oh, stop. You are so awful.
I crack myself up sometimes.
Yes, we can all hear that.
Yeah, thanks.
I recommended sea hearts. Little anecdote. I was not going to buy any new books this year. Except for ones that you obviously made me buy for this podcast.
Okay.
But no, I was going to make a wish list, you know, of books that came out this year that I wanted, and I was going to try and work through my backlist of, you know, my piles here on the sideboard. And you know, the idea was that A, by the end of the year, I would have hopefully read my entire to-be-read shelf, and B, you know, in 12 months, I might look at that wish list and go, actually, I don't really want that and that and that, and maybe that gets cold a little. And then in January, Sea Hearts came out, and I was not going to wait 12 months to read it. So I blame you, Margo, for this teetering pile of books on my sideboard.
Yeah, because once you bought one.
That's it. The gate's open.
The gate's open. You can't justify not buying others. Because the other books say, well, hey, what's so special about
you bought that one.
Correct.
You bought and read that one.
And read it. Correct. All right, so you recommended this to me.
Yes.
And I've got to say that I was 60 or 70 pages in, and I was thinking, oh, I don't really like this book. I don't know, it's all right, but I'm not really getting into it. And I was making those noises.
Were you rocking back and forth like you're doing now?
Correct. And yeah, but.
But
then page 85 comes along.
Oh, I'm going to have to look at what's page 85?
It's the page. See, this is what I'm saying.
Flipping pages.
No, it's actually not 85. It's 87.
Can I point out that page 87 is nowhere near a third of the way through the book?
No, I said the first 60 or 70 pages.
Oh, okay, sorry.
You don't even listen to what I say anymore.
No, not at all. I'm in my own world.
Anyway, and it's actually not 87 itself that is the particular scene. It's the lead up to 87, which is the whole okay, first off, really, let's go back a step. The book is called Sea Hearts.
The book is called Sea Hearts. Or for some listeners who may be in the now I'm mixed up. It's also called The Brides of Roll Rock Island, and I can't remember if that's the UK title or the US title.
I think that's the US one.
I think it's the US title. Actually, I think it was the UK title as well. I think maybe Australia was the only one who got Sea Hearts in the end.
Yeah, you're right. In fact, if we just check the copyright page,
there we go.
Published in the US and the UK as The Brides of Roll Rock Island.
Is that how it says that?
It says it in that voice. Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. So basically, we were talking about an island here, Roll Rock Island, funnily.
Yes.
Where the short version being, there is a sea witch on the island. How do you pronounce it? Miss Kayla?
I've said Miss Kayla.
Miss Kayla. Okay, Miss Kayla, who has the ability to bring out beautiful women from the bodies of seals.
Well, yeah, from Selkies.
Selkies. Yeah, see, this whole Selkie legend, didn't know it, don't know it, still haven't read it.
Okay.
I've got no idea. As far as I'm concerned, Margot actually made all this up. I have no knowledge of the Selkie legend. And I know, yes, terrible, I'm Jewish. I think that needs to be said. I've got my own cultural, mythological baggage that I know a lot about. No, because people go, what, you don't know the Selkie legend? Well,
that's annoying because, you know.
No, seriously, people will say, they go, Selkies? Everyone knows about Selkies.
I know, but I think that's annoying because no one's born with all knowledge. Or even any knowledge.
There's an assumption that you're born with an Anglo-Saxon background, and I assume that's where the Selkie stuff comes from.
Yeah, it's mainly Celtic and Scottish. I think there's maybe. I mean, it's also common in continental Europe, I believe.
Well, it ain't common in the Jewish
cities, obviously. Yes. Cold coastal cities where there are seals.
Well, I don't know about Jews living near the coast. I live near a coast, and I'm Jewish, so there's that. I think I've mentioned I'm Jewish 5 times in the space of 60 seconds.
You can probably move on.
Yeah, probably. So I wasn't aware of the Selkie legend. Tell me about it.
Oh.
Yes, I'll put you on the spot.
It's simply just that Selkies are creatures, male or female, who take the form of a seal in water and they can take off their seal skin and come onto land and take the form of humans. And the legend, the broad brushstrokes legend is basically if you can steal their skin from where they've hidden it, they will have to stay on land and be human because they cannot go back into the ocean without their skin that they put back on like a coat.
You know, I know it's a...
So that's the broad...
I know it's a well, obviously pretty reasonably well-known thing, Selkies, but I'm so glad I didn't know that.
Why?
Not because it would have – I don't know. It just I'm really –
Because you thought it was all in Margot's head.
Well, it's not that. It's that the magic of the book was still – it was all the stuff
with
the skin.
It was fresh.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It was all really fresh. Yeah. I didn't think, oh, where's that bit where the skin's going to come up, you know? And it all felt so new and fresh and different to me.
Well, it's I mean, the way she's – the angle from which she's looked at the folktale thing I think is new. I mean – not new. There's obviously
so it's
quite
not part of the folktale that the man or woman that comes from the Selkie is beautiful and gorgeous and beguiling.
Oh, well, it usually is in these cases, isn't it?
So it's sort of linked with the mermaid legend then.
Yeah, it is. There's similarities. Definitely.
Okay, well, anyway, I want to talk to you about page 87.
Page 87, yes.
Okay. So the reason why...
In the Alan and Irwin Australian edition, we should point out for readers who may have...
So it begins with a very short... The book is broken up into about 6 or 7 sections, each one named after a character.
The character who's narrating
Who will be narrating the section. So the first section is Daniel Mallet, but that's very short. That's only like a little prologue.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we get to Miss Skylar Prout, who's...
The
sea witch. It's a really interesting story, but I was finding it a bit, she gets teased, she gets picked on, she's ugly, everyone's pretty. Okay, whatever. And I wasn't really thinking that, Margot. It just wasn't grabbing me. But then she goes out and has sexual relations with a Selkie, a male Selkie, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And gets pregnant, as you do.
Yep. Because she has – her power is she has the ability to call forth the seals. I mean, they're attracted to her. That's kind of her power. And she has to wear
these straps to dampen down the power.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she gives birth to a child who she names Ian.
Yes, actually.
Yeah, what's the Scottish spelling of Ian?
Yes.
That wasn't the reason, though.
It's about me. I'm on board with this book. If only all books had characters called Ian, I would love them all.
That's not the reason. And there's this whole – it's only a few pages long, culminating in page 87, where Ian isn't growing up, isn't developing, is still
he's
a little baby,
thriving.
Isn't thriving.
Yeah.
And it got me. I didn't cry. Again, I've just become a father. Yes. I've mentioned this in about 18 different podcasts, 18 episodes of this podcast. I think I mentioned it every month, really. Mm. Shut up, Kirsten. I couldn't help but, you know, transfer.
And what does she have to do with little Ian?
No. Like, I was thinking of Joshie, and I was thinking about
I'm saying what does she have to do with her little Ian?
Yeah. Well, she has to send him out into the water because that's where he'll thrive out in the sea, and that's really sad. And without spoiling the entire book, the end brings that sort of back full circle in a way
that the ending broke me.
I really genuinely was broken at the last few pages. I couldn't hold it in. I did. Oh, no, there were actual tears. I'm not shitting you. There were tears coming from my eyes.
There's I guess it is a revelation at the end, which just – it kind of guts you.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was this whole thing about a mother and her love for a child who's not thriving and wanting to do the best for that child. Of course, every parent is like that. Mm-hmm. But when you become a parent – I'm not saying this is only specific to parents, but – I have that experience now. And all you're thinking about in those first early years of your child, are they developing? You know, there's an internet site that'll give you every fucking month an update that'll say, well, they should be doing this by now. You go, oh my God, they're not doing that.
What's wrong?
And you'll always have someone on those things saying, well, my child did that 6 months ago. It's a super child. And you're thinking, oh, mine's not. I could just feel what Miss Gale is feeling. And not only did it broaden Miss Gale as a character, it gave her those extra dimensions, which I thought was lacking in that early part because she just felt
In the early part, she's a young girl.
Yeah, I know that, but she didn't grab me as a character until...
She did actually for me the whole way.
Oh, well, we can talk about you.
Sorry.
Didn't grab me, but the moment that happened, I was there, and then I was there for the rest of the book, and I loved it. Absolutely loved every little teeny weeny bit of it.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite books, not just of this year, but this is a book I can see myself rereading every probably every 4 or 5 years. I can see my, because it's not a big book either. It's you know, it's a good book. It's a good size. You read through it. No, it's not going to weigh you down.
True. But Margot's writing is very very particular. She's got a very particular style. She doesn't write in that sort of transparent, easy to glance, skim through style.
No, she writes in a really
and it's not necessarily poetic.
Lush.
It's lush, but.
Yeah, she. It's funny because as I was reading, I mean, I really like her previous novel before this one, Tender Morsels, which I really like. I love Sea Hearts without reservation. That's what you call a callback. I did have some reservations about Tender Morsels, but Sea Hearts is just awesome, and so I'm reading it. I'm reading it, I'm enjoying it, but half of my mind, as I do now, is thinking about what I'm going to talk about on the podcast. Because I was fairly certain, even before I read it, that I was going to be recommending this one. And she's got, I mean, she has a beautiful ear for language. I think her work lends itself to reading aloud because the sounds of the words are what really make her language kind of come to life. And I watched an interview with her today on the Alan Unwin site, which I'll link to in the show notes. And she was it was just a YouTube thing, and she was answering some questions which were put there in writing. So it's just Margot talking to you. And she was talking about what she wanted people to take away from the book, and what she wanted them to take away were the sort of the smells of the island and the feel of the wind in your hair all of that, which is all in her writing. I mean, her writing, you know, I said like Bad Power in the story Bad Power in Deb's collection is really visceral in terms of having all that sensation there. And Sea Hearts is very much that as well. But
it's a very salty book.
It's a very salty book. More ways than one. But I have highlighted two extracts I just want to read. They're very brief, but they really illustrate the technical expertise that she has in her writing. And they're both okay, so the first one is actually talking about Miscela, and she is her mother is dragging her along to her grandmother's house because her grandmother's dying, and her grandmother's not – no one's very nice to Miscela, to be honest. And she doesn't really want to go to visit her dying grandmother, but, you know, her mother's dragging her along.
Her mother's really cruel to her.
So everyone is cruel to her. So she says then we were – and this is going up into her grandmother's house.
Yep.
Then we were mounting the broad steps with their sweeping balustrades like the welcoming arms of some aunt I didn't want to kiss. And it's just, it's like that extra, like the welcoming arms of a balustrade. I mean, that's great in itself.
Yeah.
Beautiful. But like, you know, like an aunt I didn't want to kiss, that just brings in all of this extra stuff into this one sentence, and you get the whole feel, like everything Miscela's feeling about going to see her grandmother and what her grandmother represents to her is kind of encapsulated in this one image. It's just perfect.
But that's why you can't zip through Margot's work.
But it's really it's not dense prose.
No. But it's that sort of passage, and I had a few as well.
My second one is just, again, and this is the way she uses language and metaphor in a way that it's not just pretty, it's not just well written, but it actually does a lot of heavy lifting to get the point of the story across. Because, you know, a lot of people can write really pretty prose, and it's just pretty, and it's like, oh, that's nice. But Margot manages to do this extra level with her writing, and this is possibly one of my favourite bits in the book.
What page is it on?
It's on page 258 for those reading along at home. And this is describing one of the sea wives who tried to escape and has drowned and has washed back up because she didn't have her skin.
That's a gut-wrenching scene.
So the people of the village of the island are going down to the shore because they've heard that she's there, her body's there. And her name's Aggie. And I'll just read this passage. Against the green grey of the sea and the mottled grey of the stony beach, white Aggie glowed. So did the pale feet of the men preparing to pull her from the shallows. The water nosed and nudged her where she lay, as if it were proud of what it had done and wanted us to praise it. And it's, that's just awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of water nudging the body and everything, but, you know, as if wanting us to... it's
like a dog.
It's like that extra level of, you know, that it's... Yeah, no, her prose is astounding. She is definitely one of our finest writers. And the way she works with language, it's just utterly enviable. It's just amazing because she not only writes beautiful prose, but she understands what the language needs to do to tell the story, and it's just stunning. I loved this book so much.
I couldn't agree more. Now, before I get on to one element, X6 is where it originated, the story.
Yeah.
Now, how does X6, which is the novella...
X6 is a novella collection that,
It's a novella
edited by Keith Stevenson that he published with his own small press, Sur de Lyon. And it's actually the opening story in this collection. This collection also contains Wives by Paul Haynes.
So worth buying, which I have my copy.
Yeah, it's a really good anthology. It opens with Sea Hearts. And I actually just reread this novella again yesterday because I wanted to... compare and contrast, really. And it's interesting because there are a couple of cosmetic changes. The island in the novella is Killy Island.
Roll Rock.
Instead of Roll Rock. Miss Kayla is, what's her name? Mescalitha. Yes. There's a few little changes like that, which I think are made for again, the sound and the rhythm of language.
Yep.
But it's basically, it opens the same way. It opens with children on the beach collecting the sea hearts, which are these,
were they scallops or something?
Well, I think they were vegetation though. I think they came from the seaweed because they kind of dried up, but they might have been a sea creature. I'm not exactly sure what they were, but they're these things that
I thought that was part of the whole Celtic thing.
The mothers like to eat. So they both open with that. What the novella does is the novella is totally around Daniel, who's one of the boys who eventually helps the sea wives escape, and himself goes back to the sea with them because he's of course half seal. He's one of the sons, and it's completely his point of view. It covers the whole time of the novel. So it begins with them on the beach. It ends with the girl from the island coming, from the mainland coming to the island. So that's covered. What's not in the novella is Miss Kayla's story. You don't get her. She's just the witch on the island.
Oh, okay. And
Trudel comes. I mean, girl, her apprentice comes, but she's in the background. You never get her point of view, obviously, and she's always the old woman who's the witch who brings the Selkies out. And so, you know, a good third of Sea Hearts, or maybe not quite a third, but, you know, a good chunk of what is Sea Hearts, which is Miscala's point of view and her story, and then Trudel's story at the end, which again brings in more of Miscala's story, is not in that novella. And I think, I mean, I really like the novella. I love the novella. It was great. I think what has been done with the novel is just extraordinary because she brings all of this out that the novella had, but she adds this extra depth and dimension of all of these people, the men, the women, the wives, Miscala, all of them sort of being in this net together and just being trapped together in this horrible situation, which you know has great beauty and joy as well, but it's
love
horrible.
The image of Miscala does this, and we get she's humanized by the fact that she has a whole section through her eyes, which is very important. But she does this. She gets a lot of money, and she collects lots of stuff that gets stuck in her first house, and she never enjoys.
She's a hoarder.
She's a hoarder. But she never enjoys the stuff.
Gets lots of money off the men to bring their wives, and that's part of it. I mean, her whole ambition really is it's a revenge story. Her whole story is revenge on the island that has shunned her. Shunned her at first because she was a bit fat and a bit plain looking,
and then shunned her
because she has this power with the seals. And so, yeah, the whole thing is kind of her revenge on the island. And you get that in the novel that you definitely don't get in the novella. And the other thing, the novella, there's a lot of violence against the wives from the husbands in the novella that's not in the novel.
Is that because of – I mean, I don't know. Is this a young adult book?
It's like all of Margot's stuff. It has been marketed as a young adult book. And there's also one thing, and you've only read this,
yes,
so you can tell me because I'm getting blurred between them. But in the novella Sea Hearts, the wives, when they have daughters, like they only have, there's only sons on the island who are the half seal, half human boys. The wives have daughters in the novella, and the daughters don't do well. They're like Ian; they don't do well, and they set them into the water, but what they do is they put the cross on them so the daughters will never be captured. But the husbands on the island think they're just returning the daughters so that one day they'll be caught again as wives. And this is sort of the spark at the beginning for the conflict between the husbands and the wives, is because the husbands inadvertently, through the actions of the sons, find out what the wives are actually doing with their daughters is actually setting them free and preventing them from ever being caught again.
That's not that element. And that's part of that element's in there, but that full – I mean, we know about the daughters being sent off.
Yes, but not that they're being prevented from
– that's not
there. And that's what I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember if
– I wonder why she took that out.
Well, in the novella, it worked with some of the violence that was,
and she's
not explicit, but very evident.
But she has removed, because there's this feeling that the men love their wives.
And the men love their wives in the novella too, but some of the men are very violent to her, especially after they find out. Because there's this horrible thing where you realise that the wives have been having sons and daughters, and sons get to stay on land and the daughters go back into the ocean, but the reason the men let that happen is because they think these daughters will be caught again. They think they're seeding the next generation of wives. It's really horrible.
Yeah.
It's just horrible. And these seal women who are doing this and freeing their daughters and marking them so they will never be caught again, like releasing them to the freedom that these women think they will never have again. It's a slightly... it's a shift in tone between the novel and the novella, which is interesting, but I can see why that changed, because in some ways the novel is a far greater exploration of that idea of the binding between the wives and the men and the damage it causes. With I mean, it's horrible enough. This is the thing. Like, Margot has made it quite horrible in the novella.
Yeah.
By taking that out... it's still horrible.
Yeah.
Like, you don't actually have to make it worse. You don't have to say, oh, it's bad because some of the husbands beat their wives.
Yeah.
It's just horrible.
Yeah.
So I like that that's been taken away and the situation kind of stands for itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the horror of it.
Yeah.
Of these women who have just been
I only read the novel, so I can't make the comparison.
And basically imprisoned on land, which is where they should not be.
But I never thought, well, shit, we need a bit more violence in this. So bring the point
the
out.
Violence is, I mean, the violence is not explicit. It's just...
but even implicit, even bruises on the, you know...
Which is what's in the novella. Yeah, so, and it's not all of the husbands by any means. It's just some of them.
I wanted to bring up... I mentioned Abigail Nussbaum last podcast. I'm going to mention her again because she does a shortish review of Sea Hearts. She raises one issue that she had, and actually it forms the bulk of her review. She seems to have more or less liked the novel, but her major problem is that you don't – well, it's actually summed up in the last sentence of her review where she says it's a missed opportunity to have given Sea Hearts its missing component – the voices of women speaking to one another, not just about each other. And what she's referring to is that the women who are originally on the island, married to the men, all decide in the novel, in an act of, in a sense of act of protection for themselves and for their daughters, to leave en masse from Royal Rock and go to the next island or the mainland. Sorry, the mainland. Nussbaum is saying is that we really don't ever get to see it from their perspective. We get a little bit early on after the Miss Scala story, you get a little perspective of basically one of the daughters of a daughter following her mother who's basically found out that her son and her husband are shagging sea wives or have made this deal with Muscala. And then later on, you, of course, get the girl who comes from the mainland.
Because, the first wives that come, it's not like the women go and the men have no one and then they get wives from the sea.
No, they've already got the wives.
They've already got mistresses, essentially.
They've made a bold decision to get up and leave. And I think...
Because one man who didn't have a wife got one from the sea. Like the first man who got one, he didn't have a wife already.
Yes, that's right.
He got one of these and then all the other men saw her and went, well, we want one of them too.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether they're married or not.
Yes, and then the other wives are going, well, yeah, that's adultery and you're treating us like shit. And
we're gone.
We're gone. which is all right. That's fine. That's not the issue. I think the point that Nussbaum is saying is that you never get that their perspective. You never get to see we know they made the decision, but you never get to see them make the decision. And then you never get to see what it did to them. You sort of get it when, was it Rebecca?
Laurie, the girl who comes back.
You get a feel for it when she comes back, but I see where she's coming from. Yep. That dialogue doesn't exist. It's all...
Yeah, no, I can see that. I'm not sure that would have done anything to the book.
Well, I don't know how Margot could have done it.
Yeah,
structurally speaking.
Structurally speaking, you just add another segment in there. The book is quite... The book is segmented.
Yes, yeah, so you just have one from
you could just have another
from
segment.
The mainland.
But I think that would have been a bit discordant with the book. And I think having the book on pretty much on the island, because every section is either completely on the island or it's people who have occasionally the islanders make a trip to the mainland and Laurie at the end has come from the mainland. But the whole book is this kind of claustrophobic thing that is on the island.
But what Abigail's saying is that there's a lack of that women relationship is what's lacking. So women from the mainland, well, women from the island versus the sea. You never get that discussion between the sea wives and the women who end up leaving. You never get that discussion. Why are you doing this?
I don't think there ever was a discussion.
Well, no, but you never.
I think that's actually made pretty plain that there was no discussion.
No, but that's the point. You never. That's her point. You don't get it at all. It's always through the eyes of the men. The discussion is held between the wives and their husbands, or Muscala. But Muscala is an outsider, so she, in a sense, doesn't count. No, she doesn't in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get the wives have a go at their husbands, and they attack their husbands, and then they leave. The wives then don't have a discussion with the actual sea wives. Now, whether you could even have a discussion of any
meaningful
discussion with the sea wives is it's never explored. That's the point, I think.
I think it's very implicit in the text that you can't. The sea wives aren't there of their own will, and it's not that they could choose to leave. So if one of the human wives said to a sea wife, you know, why are you here? Why don't you just go? I mean, what answer could she expect? And I think what the women realize, what the red wives, they refer to as the red wives because they have red hair. The islanders have red hair, whereas the Selkies have long, dark, smooth hair. And so I think for the red wives to confront the Selkie women, I think.
No, but that's the way the novel's set up, though. That's a prejudice of the novel. The novel's set up in that way, that in a sense the sea wives don't have much agency, to use that often.
But that's the horror of the novel.
Yeah, it is the horror of the novel.
Like, if the sea wives had agency, if the sea wives actually could say, yeah, we're not liking it so much here, we're going back, it would, A, be a completely different novel. I mean, it just would be a completely different novel. And, I mean, that would really tear out the sort of the darkness that is at the very core of this novel, which is this imprisonment by magic. And I think, I mean, it's a credit to the Red Wives that they don't blame the Sea Wives. They put blame where it's due. This is not women blaming other women for what the men have done, which you see so much. I mean, it's a very common cultural trope.
But the women knew about the women may have known about the skins. So their so the sons of the Sea Wives, and I love the connection. Don't get me wrong. I love the fact that it's the sons of the Sea Wives who save their mothers.
Yeah.
I love that. Beautiful. But it could have been the women. who saved the sea wives. He said, well, we know you don't want to be here. We'll go in. We'll get the coats. We'll give them to you. Off you go and you're free. But they don't. They just leave the island.
Except that I don't think the women would have been in a position to go get the coats because the men have the coats.
No,
the boys have to inveigle their way into the trust of the men to get the coats.
The women could have inveigled. Inveigled.
By their very nature, the fact that they're women, they could not go into the men's world of the pub.
You're right.
And the room where the coats.
I think the point is a credible.
It is. But I will say that the thing that I really did love about this is that it wasn't this really easy to do trope of, you know, a man doing something wrong in a relationship, having an affair, blah blah blah, and the two women are at each other instead of, you know, both of them just kicking the man out because he's an asshole. Like, the women don't do that. This is what you've done.
Yeah.
We're leaving now. We're not going to go talk to the sea wolves. We're not going to blame them. We're not going to ask them to leave because it's not on them. It's on you. And you're obviously not going to do anything. So we're just going. I mean, it's really a powerful decision they make.
Oh, and this book is full of bold decisions. The whole novel is about bold decisions.
And that it's not women against.
Miss Scala makes a bold decision for actually deciding to do this in the first place because she has doubts and she knows she's about to do something terrible. Yeah. The women of the island make a bold decision by leaving.
Yep.
Daniel's
the boy who sneaks in and takes the coats and
he makes a bold decision
to do the rescue.
Yep. And then you've got the young girl who comes from the mainland makes a bold decision to be the first woman to come to the land.
Yep.
So it's a book full of bold decisions and that's its power.
Yeah.
I suppose what Nussbaum's saying, and I see her point, is she's saying, well, one of the bold decisions could have been that the women do the saving of the other women. It's a women save women rather than sons save women. Therefore create that link. Oh, look, that's creating another – that's making it another novel that it isn't.
It's possible, but it's also – I mean, if you did that, if you had the women saving the women, if you have the red wives saving the sea wives, the red – white. Why the red wives still have? They're still stuck with these husbands.
Oh yeah, you know? But they
just,
but I don't think you'd have to change the. We'll piss off. Look, it's a completely different novel we're talking about here. We're now talking about a novel that Margot didn't write, so it's a bit. It's a bit.
I mean,
silly,
you could have had some point of view from the women who left. I just think that would have been a bit atonal with the novel because it would have taken you. I mean, I guess you could have had that discussion while they were still on the island. It could have been. I don't see that as a really inherent flaw of the novel.
I'll be honest, until I read Nussbaum's review, it didn't occur to me.
Yeah.
Okay? I didn't. It's not something I'll go,
no,
Ross,
no, I didn't. I didn't think, oh, gee,
oh my God, shit, we're missing.
Wives.
Yeah, we haven't heard from them. Shit, that's shit. Throw it against the wall. It wasn't like that at all. It wasn't until I read the review I thought, interesting perspective. That doesn't mean, though, that it's what Margot should have done because I think what she did do, even though Abigail has an issue with it, is perfectly –
Yeah, look, I think, I think
it's beautiful and brilliant.
I think that's a fair criticism. It's not one I agree with. It's one that I think if you took that line, you'd change the tone of the novel somewhat. And, yeah, look, as I said, I just love that this is one of these – quite rare occasions, I think, in our culture that you have essentially men having an affair with a younger, more beautiful woman. That's how it's framed.
Yeah.
And the wives, they don't blame the younger, more beautiful woman. They don't try and get rid of her.
Yeah, yeah.
They blame their husbands well and truly, as rightly they should. And when their husbands say, well, we're not giving up our affair, they leave. Yeah. It's awesome. It is so good and it's so rare and even though the sea wives and the wives don't talk to each other, there's kind of a not a solidarity, that's the wrong word, but there's kind of an acknowledgement that there's not the blame. They're not the enemy of each other.
Yep.
They're not each other's problems.
Yep, understood.
Yeah, and that's lovely, and that I would love to see more often in movies, in books, in all these things. I would like to see, you know, the people who do the wrong thing get the blame instead of the other people they've involved in the wrong thing.
I could speak about this novel actually for another good hour,
won't. Sean Tan.
Sean Tan.
I don't know why. Charles Tan wants us to do 4 hours, so.
Yeah, well, hey, Charles.
That's not going
to
happen.
Okay. I was about to say, yeah, why not? No. I forgot. No. The when the boys become Selkie or become seals mm-hmm. and go off, and then they come. Then some are found because the husbands go out. The fathers go out to look for their sons, and they do find them.
Yeah.
In fact, it's part of actually. It's I think it's an accident to begin with because they're
it
just
it is an accident. Yeah. Some guy cuts open a seal and a boy springs out.
It's like, oh, well, that's okay.
Maybe we can get them.
Excellent.
So they don't all come back.
No, that and there's that again. That tragedy of it's not. It's both a tragedy and yet you sort of go, well, fuck you guys because you brought this on yourself. Mm. Where some of the sons don't come back and these lonely, sad old fathers who.
I
don't know how to cope. But even when the sons
I have a little
come,
trouble feeling sorry for those fathers.
I know, but I know what you're saying, but I think Margot Lanigan wants us to feel some sympathy for them. I don't think she wants to go, hey, see what happened.
I can feel an empathy with them. Empathy. I don't feel, a lot of sympathy for them.
Right, fine. And even when Daniel comes back, his relationship with his father is changed for they just can't bond anymore.
No, because he's not really a human. He's part seal. I mean, he was having a really good time in the ocean.
Is that new? That's not part of the original myth, the children of the Selkie?
I don't know enough about. I don't know. It is in the novella. I mean, yeah, the broad arc of the book is contained.
So you had this book
spoiled
for you before you read it, in a sense.
No, well, it wasn't spoiled because I did read the novella quite a few years ago when it was first published.
Okay.
And B, it's like I said, this is a book I will imagine myself rereading quite a few times.
Yeah, it's just to get the taste of the language.
It's not a book. I don't think it's not a book that spoils. You can know everything that's going to happen step to step, and the way it's written, I think it's just a pleasure to read. It's not one of these books where once you know the ending, once you know the twist, it's like, oh, well, I don't need to read that again. It doesn't rely on suspense. It doesn't rely on
frank, the question,
not knowing what's
going to happen. The question's juvenile anyway. Oh, you spoiled the book. Blah, blah, blah.
I think there are some books and movies that would get completely spoiled. Like if they're really reliant on a twist or a surprise ending or some revelation and they're not a book that is particularly concerned with the way language necessarily works in aside from, you know, propelling you through the pages.
Yeah, understood.
Then, yeah, sometimes once you know the story and you know the ending, it's not – like it's a book which – you know, you read – I read one recently where like every chapter kind of ended on this little cliffhanger. Like it really did. And it was like, next chapter. Like, and that was so important to the way that book worked that I think once you know where every cliffhanger is going to land you on the next page, it wouldn't be nearly so interesting to read again.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It, that book would be spoilt by knowing all the little jumps.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Whereas when a book is written the way Margot Lanigan writes her book, it's just a pleasure to read, even when, sometimes especially when you know what's coming up. I mean, that's it. When you know what's coming up sometimes in a really good book,
I didn't want to know
like
what
reading
was
again, that, knowing what's about to happen.
It made me cry.
I know. Could you imagine reading it again and knowing, like when Ian's born, knowing how that works out?
Don't even mention it.
I know. It's crushing. And that ending, oh, God. The ending is just. Oh.
And it wasn't just because his name was Ian.
No, I know.
Seal, mark, stamp of approval. Sea Hearts by Margot Lanigan.
Was that a pun?
Oh, seal. Oh, my God. I didn't even know I was saying it when I said it. Yes.
The seal of approval.
For Sea Hearts. Yes. No, brilliant. Love it.
It
beautiful.
Is.
Will
it is.
Should be nominated for a bunch of things in 2013 because it's worthy of it. Because it came out this year, 2012.
I would really hope so. Yeah, it was a very early book this year, which might be the one thing that might stand against it because people often do forget about very early books. But well, hell, when award season comes around, I'm going to plug the hell out of this book.
Look, it's a walk up. it's a walk up. Player for Ditmars and Aurealis next year. I mean, if this doesn't appear, you'd have to.
I would hope to see this on the World Fantasy Ballot. I think. I mean, I've said this.
I wasn't
before.
Not there yet. I'm saying Australian Awards. Oh, okay. It will be there. If it's not there, there's something fundamentally wrong with Australian Awards. Internationally, you'd think World Fantasy.
I would think World Fantasy. I mean, It's what I said about Deathless when we read it, is that I think that's Sea Hearts, like Deathless, is exactly the type of book you want on a world fantasy ballot. It's situated completely within the fantasy genre. It's beautifully written. It's a book that has important things to say without being didactic. It's a book that I think, you know, it experiments with style and form.
Yep.
It's exactly the kind of book which should be on the ballot. Care who wins, honestly. I'm not so concerned with winners with awards. I think shortlists and ballots are really, really important.
I agree.
And I would hope that if Sea Hearts is not on the World Fantasy ballot next year, the five books that are just perfect.
They better fucking well be. You going to say about the five books or six books that appear this year if Deathless isn't there? I think I would, because Deathless – I would think
– Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Deathless should be –
Deathless is an awesome book.
Is it a Lay Down Mazir? Is that how you say it?
What now?
Lay Down Mazir, you know, the obvious – it doesn't matter. All right. We've done the books.
Yes, so we're definitely, definitely, definitely recommending both our books tonight. Yes.
Actually, Bear Power, it can't be nominated for anything because it came out late in 2011, so it's
– Yeah, it had the reverse thing. Like, it came out very late and I think it maybe skipped some reading lists possibly because it came late.
Yeah, so go back in time and –
But, you know, it got nominated for an Aurealis, so.
Yeah, all right, okay, fine. Well done, Deb, for that Aurealis. So, episode 20.
Oh, yes, exciting news.
Woo and hoo.
Shut up.
So, episode 20 is
exciting, exhausting news. I'm exhausted just thinking about it.
This is really, really difficult. Episode 20 is our next episode.
Yes.
Because this is 19.
That's right. And it will be recorded live. Well, we always record live.
On June the...
We haven't got an absolute confirmation of the date.
Well, we do.
It's over the continuum.
We do know, don't we?
No, it's over the continuum. Continuum 8 in Melbourne. It's over the Queen's Birthday long weekend. I think it might be on the Sunday, but I'm not entirely sure. But it doesn't matter anyway, unless you're at Continuum, in which case you'll have a program. Yeah. And
someone may just turn up for us.
And if you're not, it will be uploaded sometime the following week. But yes, we're doing another Continuum live recorded podcast with an audience, which is always exciting.
Well,
it's exciting to
have. No, but people have to turn up.
What?
They might have thought, I heard them last year.
Well, we have two guests, which we didn't have last year.
Oh, yes. Well, no, we had Kat Valenti last year.
Yeah, but these are two new guests, so people won't just say, oh, we've heard them last year. Because they're new people. It's not just us. They've heard us. But they've not heard the other people who will be with us.
So they're the guests of the convention.
They are.
Alison Goodman and Kelly Link.
Yes.
Now, here's what we did.
Yes.
We couldn't be asked recommending books and them recommending books.
No, actually, we couldn't be asked. We listened to the feedback from our listeners who said, you guys, when you have guests on and you have three books, sometimes the podcasts are really long or you don't talk about all the books enough. And it's like it's really good when you just have two books. And we figured if we had two guests on, each of us picking a book, that's four books. Went, no, that's not going to happen.
No.
No.
No. Also, my reasoning that I couldn't be asked, but you're right.
Be asked.
So what we asked our guests to do was to recommend books to us.
Yes.
So we didn't recommend anything.
No.
So these are books that they've recommended, and it's their bloody fault they're no good.
Oh.
So.
You haven't even read them.
How do you know? Maybe I've written all.
I asked you before.
Yeah, but you're not meant to tell
them.
It's magic of the podcast. You're meant to not tell people that I haven't read stuff yet.
Anyway. Have they recommended, Ian?
Thanks, Kirsten. I will answer that question. The books will be The Crystal Singer by Anne McCaffrey. It's my very first taste of the McCaffrey.
Me too.
So that should be fascinating.
And that was recommended by Alison.
That was recommended by Alison Goodman. And The Scorpio Races by Maggie Stavarta. I'll go with that pronunciation.
which is a pretty new book. I think it was only out at the beginning of this year.
Yeah, so that was recommended by Kelly. She actually gave us a few choices, but she was...
She gave us two.
No, I think it was more than two.
Okay.
Doesn't really matter.
Anyway, we picked that one.
Now, here's the thing. Even though we're doing... you have something to
I'm
say?
I'm just saying, so all four of us will be reading those two books and just talking about those two books.
Yes.
And that will be sometime in June.
Yes, I'm glad you repeated that because obviously it wasn't clear when we said
shut
3 minutes ago.
Moving on.
So this is the issue. Even though that's episode 20, it's not actually the next episode we'll be recording.
No.
In fact, it's not even the next episode we'll be recording.
We're recording two more before that.
Before that episode. Those two more episodes, and we'll say who they are because they've already bloody well spoiled it on Twitter anyway.
Oh.
I was going to keep it a surprise until the very day. But anyway, it doesn't matter. They'll be recorded on the Thursday and Friday just before
Continuum. No, the Wednesday and Thursday.
Shit, that's right. Yeah. Before Continuum. My wife's really happy that I'm not going to be home two nights in a row. No, she's having a party and all everything.
So the Wednesday
will be Jonathan Strahan.
Yes.
We're not telling you what books.
Not yet.
But that is a traditional episode in that it's three books. So it's his recommended one and we've recommended.
Yes.
And then the following night, not that you will hear it the following night, we've got Angela Slater.
You spoiled the magic of podcasting, Ian.
Shush. We've got Angela Slater and Lisa Hannett.
Angela Slater.
Slater.
And yes.
I'll say, is it Alyssa or Elisa?
Oh, stop.
I've been so much trouble. It's Angela Slater.
Yes, and Lisa Hannett.
And Lisa Hannett.
Award-winning authors both.
Yes, that's right. Yes. And they've already recommended their two books, so we're
doing
mentioned.
Yes, again, we're only doing two. They're recommending two. We're not recommending any, so that will be a two-book podcast.
So
we're recording all of that in less than a week. But we will still release them monthly. Once a month because we're not mad. And it would be nice to have a reading holiday. Yeah, I'm going to read books I don't have to read.
And I'm going to catch up on last short story because I haven't done a last short story post since March.
Yeah, that will be the June, July, August podcast.
Yes, and it'll probably be in that order. It'll be the Continuum one, then Jonathan, then Angela.
Yeah, I think so. We'll do the Continuum one first because that was in the month. And that's like the big one for the month. Yes. Continuum was in June.
Yes.
And then we'll just put the other two up in the order we recorded them.
Yes.
And don't worry, we'll let you know the books because we'll do some weird podcasty future magic and make sure all the books are accounted for so you'll know what to read a month.
Well, we already know the books, so there's no magic.
Yeah, but we're not announcing them now.
No, but...
We're just doing them out of order. You're not... Stop it.
Okay.
It's magic.
All right.
Let me have my magic.
You can have your magic. Now, there's a couple... before we get to there was feedback, actually. My friend, and he comes out... Do you know my friend...
Jonathan McCalmont?
Not Macca. No,
your
not,
other friend.
Yeah. Well, he's not Rob Shearman.
Your other friend.
Can I finish?
Okay.
So my Twitter comes up on my phone, like most people does, because they get a push notification. So my wife picks up my phone once and says, "Who the hell's Charles Satan?" Because, he says, good morning,
yes,
good
yes,
evening.
Yes, yes,
yes. Yes. So I thought I'd just say that. Yes. Yeah, so... Charles Tan,
yes,
our friend from the Philippines, that is where he's from.
Yes.
Thank God I got that right because that was right off the top of my head, has offered to take all the books that we've done so far.
He's done it actually. It's all done.
Yeah, all right. I'm giving you the narrative here.
Okay,
offered to do it, which is take all the covers of all the books we've done so far and turn it into a Pinterest.
Which I'm scared to look. Well, I've looked at the board that he made, but I'm scared to register for Pinterest and because I just think that that can't be good for Kirsten. all my time will go.
Yeah, it will. On the other hand, though, don't give a crap. But I do love the fact that someone has done this because
it
looks gorgeous.
Awesome.
It looks gorgeous.
Look at all the covers. Yeah, it's amazing. I can't believe we've read and talked about all those books.
Now, we're hoping that Charles will maintain this until we stop doing the podcast forever. So, because I ain't maintaining it. But look, it's up to him. But I would love to thank him because that is a way.
It looks really great.
But it's more
and
than that.
We'll link to that in the show notes.
Someone I've never met.
I've met him. Charles is lovely.
When did you meet Charles?
He was at World Fantasy.
So you've met Charles. I've never met Charles. He's just a Twitter person to me. And no, he's more than that. And he also does the website and all that, Biblical Stalker and all that.
But yes, you only know him online.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's so wonderful that he's gone and it's just a lovely community
sometimes.
I think
it's great.
Well, we're not having flame wars about all sorts of other issues.
Oh, that's part of it.
Well, it is. It's part of the fun. But
love and hate.
So, that's right. And look, we have had feedback. On Twitter, we've had people saying how much they're loving the podcast.
Yes.
I haven't really...
And how much they're cursing us for making them buy lots of books.
Yes, which is good because we only... Well, actually, we do recommend some shit. No, we don't recommend or we read some books, but we tell you this shit. So,
not much.
So, well, okay.
Mostly
true.
We like the books.
I've heard different. I've heard people say, you always hate the books. You always rag on the books.
No, that's because the negative stuff is what sticks in people's head. It's like if people give you 10 compliments and then say one bad thing about your hair, the thing about your hair will just stick in your head forever and those 10 compliments, they're gone.
Yeah, true.
But the negative stuff always sticks, even when that's not negative about you.
Should we wrap up?
Yes. There's one more thing you wanted to mention.
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry.
It's on the show.
Yeah,
notes.
It's on the show. Yeah, it's because we changed the order. So also, there's a competition. It's not actually our competition.
No.
It's Hesperus Press's competition, which is Uncover a Classic competition. That's the name of it.
Can you say competition one more time?
I'm doing a really shit job here. Sorry, Hesperus Press. But anyway, look, a bit of background for them.
Yes.
They were established in 2002. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary. They've published some 300 works by many of the great figures in worldwide literary history. 300 works.
And works that have been out of print until they republished them.
Which is why I really wanted to support this, because I love that whole idea. So they've done Dante, Dickens, Dostoevsky, Flaubert, Kafka, Tagore, Tolstoy, Wolfe, and others. So anyway, the competition is, I've said it again, they're asking readers, so Hesperus Press is asking readers to help us uncover a classic by submitting to us the name of one out-of-print book they would like to see back in print. Entrants must write an introduction to the book in no more than 500 words, explain why they love their chosen book and why it deserves to be republished. The winner, chosen by Hesperus Press editorial team, will see the chosen book published by the press in September 2012, containing their 500-word introduction. So get your entries in now. It is a pretty tight deadline. Of 1st of June 2012. This podcast will probably go out
next couple. You might have about 10 days.
Minutes.
You might have about 10 days to get your entries.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's fine. You've only got to write 500 words.
So that's like 550 words a day. There'll be more information. There's more information on their website, which obviously we'll do a link to because we'd be silly if we didn't. So I love people who like to uncover things that are out of print.
And they're doing, like, I had a very quick look at their website and they seem to be doing, okay, they've published Tolstoy, for instance, but obviously it's not War and Peace, because that's out. I don't know if that's ever been out of print. It's a very good doorstop, that book. But, you know, there might be a novella out there which has long been out of print.
Yeah.
And so they'll resurrect that. So it's not like obviously the big books, but it can be by famous authors. It can also be by authors who are more obscure. It's quite a good idea. So, and they have, I also like, you have to, the book has to be in English or an English translation.
Yep.
But they do have a lot of authors outside of native English speakers, albeit in translation, but, you know, that's what you get.
So this competition gets the seal stamp mark of approval from Writer and the Critic. Well, it does, because we just announced it.
Yeah.
We've never done a competition, have we?
Well,
we do know the ebook one.
The ebook one kind of kind of a competition.
Yeah, we've got to sort of think of who wins.
Well, we've got to read the ebooks, and the ones where we've actually liked enough to talk about, the people who recommended those, I think, are getting a book.
Oh.
Not an ebook, an actual book.
All right, well, that's new to me. Anyway,
don't you ever listen to the, don't you remember what you say?
I didn't say anything on this issue. This has
you
been your
did.
The whole
we did
ebook
the whole
things,
thing.
But we're not having this discussion now, okay? All
okay.
right.
Okay.
It's in the prenuptials. Just read them. So
was that thing you made me sign when I was drunk?
Yeah.
Oh.
I did. So anyway, feedback.
You know,
no feedback. No, what am I talking
about?
I'm
not actually having a firstborn, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's done anyway. His name's Joshua Ethan Mondarello. So please send feedback to – it's Mond. I just sometimes add it. Please send feedback to – well, follow us on Twitter first off. And actually, thank you for people who are following. There are more people following us.
Sure.
So on Writer and Critic, I know I should put more content on it, blah, 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 but I don't. Comment on the website, which people do every so often, but not really.
Including actually Mark Webb.
Mark Webb
was
did
really
it again,
cool.
Didn't
he came back. He told a little anecdote of his daughter. They were crossing at a crossing sign and the little daughter said something about the green man, and he said, "Why do you think it's a green man?" And she didn't have an answer, and now they call her the green woman.
Oh.
I really like that.
Oh, that's lovely. So you could be like Mark Webb too and put great stuff on our website, which we'll then talk about, and then it'll be turned into Zazzle stuff.
Yes.
You can email writerandcritic@gmail.com. So you can email us at writerandcritic.
You're very bad at this.
@gmail.com. Well, who said? I mean, you do it better. I admit that.
It's your turn.
And yes, true. And finally, you know what to do on iTunes. I'm not even going to mention it. And
that's it.
That's really it.
We're done.
We are done. We can't wait to see our billions of fans at Continuum, Continuum 8. Really.
If Zazzle gets its button gear, we might have buttons and stickers and things to give out at Continuum.
Oh, I hope we do.
That would be cool.
In fact, if you buy me a Zazzle t-shirt, I'll wear it.
I don't think I have time now because they've taken so long to get my first order that I don't know if there'd be time to get you something for Continuum.
Oh, well, stuff
we'll
that
see.
Then.
Maybe I will.
Maybe just draw on my naked body as I'm sitting there doing the podcast.
You're going to do it naked?
Some people have asked, and, you know, our fans. Anyway, that's it for me. I'll leave you on that note. That's a lovely image. Good night from me.
Good night, everybody.
Bye. Bye. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a not Hugo... No, start that again.